We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we're continuing our Series 9 Doctor Who coverage with the two-part adventure Under the Lake and Before the Flood by Toby Whithouse. I wonder if that's Whithouse or Whitehouse without an
Whitehouse,
E.
That was Whitehouse, but I...
There's no E.
Then it's Whithouse.
And that's just not a name I've ever heard before. Well,
no,
Toby...
No, I mean, I guess my mind plugged in the E there automatically.
Without sans an E, except at the end where it has an E for house. Otherwise, it would be Whithoos.
As you say.
As I say. this episode, two-parter, first part, Doctor ends up in this underwater facility that's an underwater mining facility, and there are ghosts chasing people around, and the Doctor realizes that he has to go back in time to find out what happened so that he can prevent it from happening to save Clara, etc., etc., etc. So in part two, he goes back in time to the same location, but I think that's supposed to be Scotland. And there he encounters the strange creature that has caused all the trouble in the future and solves it, sort of. So if you haven't seen it, you know, why are you listening to... It's, you know, it's not like you need a synopsis for a 30-year-old episode you can't find. You should be able to watch this one on the air. So, what did you think about the episode?
It really, in many ways, it felt like two totally different stories.
Mm-hmm.
The first part, very much a ghost story. And while you did have some of that carry over into the second, part two, largely given to its location. I mean, most of the story, I think, well, I didn't time it, but at least half, if not more than half, is not on the sea base,
mm-hmm.
but in 1980 Scotland, which mm-hmm. looks like Russia,
mm-hmm.
With a monster.
With a monster, yeah.
So it felt like two different stories.
I don't think these people understand what a two-part story is. I mean, this is, yeah, it's kind of two story. It's, well, no, it's, I'm not even going so far as to say it's two stories tacked together. It's one story and some other stuff tacked to it. Yeah, not that I didn't like it.
Which made it a little disjointed. I liked each for their own specific merits. But when I look at the episode as a whole or the story as a whole, again, it feels a little disjointed.
Mm.
But I liked it.
I particularly liked the first part.
I really liked the first part more than I liked the second,
yeah.
Which seems to fly in the face of most other people. Most people that I've been reading seems to like part two better. I liked part one better.
No, definitely part one was better. It had tension. It had something that you were working against. It had, it had interesting characters in it, and it had a really good cliffhanger in its way.
Yeah.
And
it was also coming off as a good ghost story too, which made it a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. And then we get into the second part of it, which my complaint about the last story with Davros holds true here too. The Doctor fumbles around throughout the episode, and then when he pops out of the container at the end, which, you know, I think everybody knew
saw it coming.
He was in the container. But when he pops out of the container at the end, he explains how he solved it. Yay, life's great. And story over. And once again, we don't see the Doctor being clever. We see the Doctor kind of fumble around. And then we see him tell everybody, look what this clever thing I did again was.
Well, yeah, it was done that way. There was a little bit of telegraphing, a little bit. More so this time than we got with the situation with Davros. I mean, we do get our little prologue regarding the bootstrap paradox. So we're getting that set up. already that something that there's going to be a hitch that's going to go on here. My big gripe, though, is the hologram.
Mm-hmm.
How is that being projected? And don't tell me
magic.
It's while he. It's got to be magic, unless he's. Well, no, the TARDIS isn't
it's
there.
The TARDIS. Well, who says the TARDIS can't project
through time?
Thing through time.
Possibly.
Or maybe he's got the holo projector in his pocket and
while he's in the suspended animation casket.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So if you're gonna ask questions, you gotta figure out where you got that cup of tea.
But see, the cup of tea was given a hand wave based on that very.
So
you know,
was the story.
Based on the address.
So was the story, and it was given a hand wave in
what?
That
by the
Beethoven.
Prologue?
Yes, it was.
Yeah,
it's like,
well,
I'm just going to explain to you why this can't make any sense before I even try to slap you upside the head with it.
And you're right. You're absolutely right. As far as the time travel aspect of it goes, as far as the paradox goes, you're right. I accept it. Because of that very prologue, it's the hologram that I'm stuck on, because that's the one technical aspect of this in which really the bulk of the Doctor's scheme hitches on. And I have a problem with that. There's no explanation as to how he managed to get that hologram to actually work.
No.
And that's where I get stumped.
The whole thing kind of just doesn't. Because nothing gets shown being done, that one doesn't bother me any more than how did the canister get next to the dam?
Yeah, that was weak.
When did we get the moment for him to go do that? You know, I mean, we see him through his first pass where the woman gets killed, and then he tries to leave in the TARDIS, and the TARDIS not only refuses to allow him to make a paradox, or at least that appears to be what's going on, right?
Right.
But then the TARDIS takes him back 20 minutes in time, which would seem to be even more inclined to create a paradox.
Yes, especially he throws out a line which made me kind of uncomfortable. And he says, we have to, and I cannot quote it, but he says something to the effect of, we must wait until we catch up with ourselves. I'm like, what?
How will you ever catch up with yourselves? Unless
yeah, you're
you mean
always
the moment
20 minutes
when
off.
When they Don't, leave, I guess.
Oh, okay, fine.
That was how I had to take
so
it.
Then,
like at the point when that TARDIS disappears, then we can run around safely because they're gone.
They're gone, but they will be 20 minutes behind you. So
but they're going
to
hide.
There's
so
knowledge
you don't have to worry
now.
About it.
There'll be some kind of really weird knowledge. So
but
yeah, you are creating a paradox at that point as well. It gets very that's a timey-wimey I don't like.
Well, they won't know about it until they get back, and then they'll know that they're seeing themselves, but they won't know what they themselves in the future will still be doing,
right.
Which is the Doctor will lock one guy up in the TARDIS, and then he'll go talk to the Fisher King and say, I'm going to beat you, and then boom, damn goes TARDIS emergency protocol, and then, oh, it was a hologram. Ha! Huh, program solved.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
What I don't like about this.
No, you're
that.
Right, and there is one thing. Okay, I get where at one point, you know, the Doctor's kind of like playing the old David Tennant thing. I'm not ready. Okay, and fine. And all of a sudden, we see him walk up to the chapel and then say, okay, now I'm ready. Now, we're all led to believe that this is him saying, okay, I'm ready to face my death. There is not even a hint. I mean, they don't have to give it away that he's figured some trick out. They don't have to do that. They could at least give us some kind of a hint that he has an idea.
You know, it's odd that you should say that, because when he said, now I'm ready, I just assumed that he was finally going to go do something. I mean, I didn't take that as a fatalistic, I'm ready to die. I took that as, now I'm ready to finally get off my rear end and do something. And then he just goes down into the Fisher King and talks to him and looks a little peaked and worried. And so, again, it was like, I don't know what the heck is going on here. Yeah, I think Toby Whithouse is trying to do a timey-wimey story, and he's trying to do it differently than Moffat does them, and I applaud them for getting away from Moffat's timey-wimey style of story, and I think that there is a whole lot of fascinating things that you can discuss when it comes to temporal paradoxes, because it is a you know, as a thought experiment, it's a fascinating exercise.
But that becomes your sole focus of the episode, you can become a little bit sloppy when it comes to the details. And there, I'm not talking so much about the details of the paradox itself and how that gets executed, but by not leading your viewer along a little bit onto the ride, like in the case of the Doctor showing that he really is clever. I mean, there is no evidence of him showing any kind of scheme that he's going to work, that he's going to try and work something out.
Mm-mm.
We get none of that. And, like, again, we don't need to see him come up with a full-blown plan and then explain it to everybody before he executes it. No, I don't want that. But I want to get some kind of an idea that he does have a plan, that he is executing something to try and work out of it.
He's not the victim of circumstance, which is what he
appears
to
be. Right, and that's what I was getting, is that I was getting the idea that he was the victim of circumstance. And from what we learn later is that the entire time the Doctor is, you know, saying, you know, it's the future, I'm going to die. I mean, he really believes it because he talks about the desperation that he's feeling at the message that he gets from Clara. So we understand that he truly believes, at least for a time, that he is going to die. But at what point does he realize, oh, I don't have to, I could do something different? We don't even get that moment.
It almost has to be in the moment right before he says, I'm ready.
It's got to be.
It has to be at the moment. It has to be. He kind of snuck off to see the slimy dude. And then the next we see him approaching the chapel and he says, now I'm ready. So in that time, he must have gone off, got the power cell, taken it, planted it in the bomb, created the hologram, started projecting it into the future, and then went in and got the Fisher King out of the way so he could hop in the canister. And so it had to be at that moment. But
oh, I agree. But there's no indication of it. We don't figure that out, or at least we don't get any suggestion of that until well after the fact. And I do feel a little cheated in that respect. And that could be the moment where we could even possibly get actually, that wouldn't be a good moment. Actually, you know, I was thinking about, again, coming back to the hologram. But it would have been nice to get some kind of a suggestion that this is where he's going to go. I mean, and even at that very moment, I mean, even if at some point, you know, right as he's about, you know, right when he comes up with the idea, even if he at that very moment just kind of stops and says to himself, bootstrap paradox, then we know, all right, he's on to it. He's got something figured out. It doesn't have to be a full-blown explanation, but as long as we get an idea that he has figured something out, then we're along for the ride. We don't know what the result is going to be, but we're along for that ride at that point.
I like to see the Doctor working towards a plan, even if we don't know what the plan is. You know, it's kind of like the A-Team. They're in there and they're building stuff, but you can't figure out what it is until it comes bursting out of the garage. And it turns out they've just built an M1 tank out of something.
Yeah.
There is that now the hero has a sense of purpose. Now the hero is working against the enemy instead of just resigning himself to his clerical error regeneration fate.
Mm-hmm.
They could have done a lot. They could have done a lot with your hologram problem if they had done more in the first episode, where they set up the hologram emitter. You know, in that they just say, well, the TARDIS is helping to produce the hologram. But if they had set up some equipment in the base, if they had wired the base up in some way,
true.
Then
because
the Doctor could have sonicked it through the iPhone to the into the holo emitters in the base, which are in the present.
That would have worked.
It's
technobabble, but it would have worked. I mean, it's something. Mm-hmm. Instead of just automatically assuming, oh, we've got a ghost out there now. Oh, wait, it's not. Surprise.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know.
And why did he let the other ghosts out? I don't remember again. He let him out of the Faraday cage, his hologram. Was that so they wouldn't be suspicious?
You know, I honestly do not remember why.
There is no reason. It's just because he's playing the ghost.
I guess that's it. He's just
the
playing
the
ghost.
So the only reason he did it was to scare and possibly kill Clara and the others by letting the ghosts out, which...
But what purpose does that serve?
it doesn't serve any purpose.
Yeah,
that's the whole point.
Yeah, I mean,
unless it's to motivate the doctor to get on with it and save her life. So, well, she's not in danger, so I'm in no hurry. I mean, that is kind of the reason he was mouthing the names, or at least that's what he claims was the reason he was mouthing their names.
It's possible that knowing that he had done that, because he does talk about the desperation that he's feeling. So it's very possible that he feels by Clara relating to him, oh, guess what? The ghosts are now out, that it might give him that motivation to do something, to get that sense of desperation as he desperately needed in order to come up with some kind of a solution to save her. So that's the only thing that I can think of, you know. But again, we're falling back into that paradox kind of situation where, okay, at some point in my future, I'm going to let them out because I need Clara in the further future to let me know in the past that this is going on, so that I will feel motivated to do that in the future.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly the problem. We're not going to solve, and then, of course, this part of it is we're not going to solve the bootstrap paradox.
You can't. No, that's the whole nature of it. You can't solve it.
Or, I mean, because
especially in this particular case, I mean, there is no point in time where you have the original thought.
Mm-hmm.
It does not exist.
Assuming that time always existed. A strict series of linear events.
Yeah. It will have always existed. You know, and this is not the first time the Doctor Who has played with this kind of thing either.
Well, Day of the Daleks was a very good example. I think that's the first time we had a bootstrap paradox there, and that's where the rebels from the future came back to kill the man who they thought assassinated killed everyone at a conference, which started the war, but it was their assassination attempt that blew it up, that caused the war. And it's only the fact that the Doctor, as a Time Lord, is able to penetrate into that paradox and change things. So here we have the Doctor himself, part of his own paradox.
What do you think about that? I keep questioning. You know, this comes back to what we saw with Angels in Manhattan, where Rory sees his own headstone.
Mm-hmm.
And now the future's set.
Your future is set. There is a headstone here with your name on it. That doesn't mean you're in it.
Right. So the Doctor all of a sudden gets this message from Clara in the future. He sees his ghost, or what he believes to be his ghost, and now he says, well, that's it. I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot change that. And I'm thinking, really?
Yeah.
I have a problem with that.
Unless the theme this year is the Doctor's fatalistic.
And I'm kind of wondering if that isn't it.
Because it is two in a row now.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering if that isn't the situation here, where he's caught into these fatalistic situations, or at least what he perceives them to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if that isn't it. Because I could see him easily, and, you know, I think back to, like, Pyramids of Mars, for example,
mm-hmm.
where the Doctor and Sarah, they amscray from the Victorian house where Sutek is being summoned, and head off back. You know, they bog off back to present day England, and now the world's a mess.
Yep.
So, okay, they've just seen their future. It's not set. What do? They go back and they fix it. They kill Sutek.
It's as if different writers.
Yeah, imagine that.
Seem to keep an inconsistent pattern as to how time travel works, which is problematic.
I mean, the bootstrap paradox, okay, I mean, it makes for an interesting plot device for this particular story, but I don't buy into it, at least not in this particular situation. I'm not buying into it at all.
Yeah.
I don't know. It made for an interesting story. I did enjoy it, but when the Doctor kept going off, saying, I can't change it. I've seen my future now. It is the future. And I'm like, the future is what you make of it. Just because, I mean, you've traveled through time now, you know, just shunt off into, if you want to buy into, you know, quantum mechanics and all that sort of thing about alternate timelines, then okay, then you bog
quantum mechanics. If you buy into that stuff.
Oh, I know. What am I saying? I mean, this is science fiction.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying.
So, yeah, I've easily, you know, changed the situation. Next thing you know,
it's wibbly wobbly.
Yeah, it's wibbly wobbly, you know, timey wimey. You know, you change a little bit here, change a little bit there, jump back into the present, and guess what? Everybody's like, well, why did you leave, Doctor? And everybody's happy and everybody's alive and you've just saved the day.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, you get into this sort of deus ex machina kind of situation that you don't want to – you don't want to have that be too omnipresent in a lot of your stories because then the Doctor becomes just way too powerful with the time-traveling device. Yeah. But it's better than this whole bootstrap paradox. I mean, it reminds me of what I think is called the Nabokov self-consistency principle, which is just a really, really fancy way of saying fixed points in time.
Yeah, which is, you know, this is nothing you can contribute on an intellectual level to a discussion about this. This is the problem, is it's just, you have to accept it, and you know, and They went out of their way to make sure you understood that it's not going to make any sense, so don't worry about it.
I know, but you know, and I understand this is a more of a philosophical argument or philosophical discussion, you know, whether the Doctor is truly a victim of the paradox or not. I personally don't like it, but by virtue of having it being introduced in the prologue, I accept that it is a part of the story. And I just and I give it the hand wave. I move on. And in that respect, I did find the story interesting. Not perfect by any means. It's got the one, well, the two big flaws, and that is, well, actually, flaw and one minor flaw. What?
I was going to say there is one thing about this bootstrap paradox that. As you said, Rory sees his own tombstone and then it's all done. The Doctor did not actually see his own ghost. His ghost didn't appear until after he had already gone back into the past.
Yeah, which means something that he does in the past is what creates the ghost.
Creates the ghost. That's all that really says, not right. That he's dead. So that's not really – the paradox comes in that he's afraid that it really is a ghost.
Yes.
And – therein lies the problem is that I'm not sure that's quite the same. Anyway, I'm sorry. That just, it's my thought. It's just interesting that he didn't send the ghost to appear at a time while he was still there. He sent the ghost to a period of time after he'd left. And I don't know if there's a significance to that. Probably not, other than it just made for a great cliffhanger, because then you go away and then as soon as the Doctor's gone, he's dead.
That's it. I think it was purely a story narrative. You know, and I was just reminded of something. The Doctor's in two places at the same time.
That's why the TARDIS didn't want to land.
Several times. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I think that's why it had issues when it first arrived to the base, because he's in that bloody coffin.
He's already there, yeah.
He's already there.
Which, yeah, so if the TARDIS hadn't landed in the first place, and it's the TARDIS that brings him there, would the bootstrap paradox ever have occurred? Why didn't the TARDIS, which we know can take him where he needs to be, why didn't the TARDIS just take him to Scotland in the first place to prevent this? It's yeah, we're not going to get anywhere. So you had something else to say first.
Well, I was going to simply say that aside from one big issue and one small issue, the big issue being why don't we see the Doctor be clever, you know, and actually scheme to get out of what he perceives to be the paradox, I would have liked to have seen something. And again, it doesn't have to be a full-blown explanation as to what he's going to do, but show me that he's planning something. Show me that he's being intelligent and before he faces the Fisher King, as opposed to just, okay, I'm ready. You know, give me something.
Mm-hmm.
And then the minor thing is, yeah, how the hell is that hologram actually showing up in I don't want to call it present day, but at the sea base.
At the sea base,
I would have liked some tiny bit of explanation, and that wouldn't have taken long. You know, like Clara saying, "Hang on a minute, Doctor, how did you do that?"
I programmed your iPhone.
Well, yeah. even if you went on to say, you know, you ever wondered how I managed to get those cup of tea all the time? you know, how I managed to get all the things out of my pockets, you know, things like that. And she says, yeah. And he says, same thing. Okay, I would have moved on.
So
something.
Yeah. What about, I'm going to keep on the second part of this story for a little bit, just because it's the second part of the story. And that in itself is an issue. But Scotland, abandoned town, all the Soviet stuff all around it.
Mm-hmm.
Why did they spend money to make all the Soviet propaganda stuff for that town when wouldn't a simple, it's an abandoned town in Scotland, suffice?
Yeah, yeah, the whole idea of, oh, it's a military proving ground, it's like a training ground. Okay.
Had no bearing ultimately on the story.
It has no influence, none. It's, I remember seeing an interview with George Lucas, and he was talking about, you know, some of the things that he inserted, you know, with the special editions of Star Wars. And he says, you know, there are several reasons why a director will put things in. And one of them is whimsy. And I'm kind of getting the feeling that the whole bit with this fake Russian town in this area of Scotland was done purely for whimsy.
It's a lot of whimsy.
It's a lot of whimsy, and I found nothing whimsical about it.
Yeah,
but the whimsy of the writer / director, whoever was responsible for that, I mean, it's their whimsy. I got no whimsy out of it.
Let me just try this one on you. What would have stopped them from saying that the cage was at the bottom of a lake in former Soviet Union?
You know, that would have worked.
Exact same difference. Yet for some reason, it's in Scotland pretending to be Russia, which has absolutely no bearing on why the Fisher King is there, the events, nothing that the Doctor does to save the day. It's completely and absolutely, utterly without any bearing on the story whatsoever.
It's totally irrelevant.
Yeah.
It's just there.
It's just there. Unless it's there so that when people are watching the pictures, they're going to be writing on the internet, I think the Doctor's going to Soviet-era Russia. You know, and that would be a heck of a stretch in the conspiracy theory annals. To think that they would do that just to mess with the heads of people trying to get photos of the sets.
Mm.
Anyway, that was one. So here's the thing. With regards to the second episode, and I think I safely say we have talked largely about the second episode entirely. And yes, it's a little fresher in our memories. But here's the thing. I thought the first episode was excellent. I really felt that we were going to be getting an incredibly solid classic Doctor Who story from end to end. And
wow, you did? I didn't.
I did. But I felt completely derailed when we got into the second one from that. I'm like, oh, you know, they did all that work. They set up a good premise. They set up a good tension. They set up decent characters and Jeopardy and the whole nine yards. And this second half of it undermined it. Not that I didn't enjoy the second half, but it undermined all of the work done in the first half, which was largely, you know, a bit of investigative and suspense building.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And I feel it really detracts from the first.
Absolutely.
The part we're all talking about is the end and not the good stuff at the beginning, which was cheapened out.
And because you've now split the story, especially when you get to part two, and you've got one chunk of your story taking place on the base, another chunk of the story that is now happening in 1980 Scotland, any dramatic tension that you're trying to build keeps getting interrupted. So even though we still saw Clara and Cass being chased by the ghost. Oh, you know, it does kind of take away a little bit. I wasn't getting the exact same tension. Now, one thing that I did really like in terms of just a little bit of story moment, and that's after Cass ran away and she's going down the corridor and she doesn't realize that she's now being stalked by the ghost with the axe because she's deaf. And I like how, you know, it's a nice dramatic moment where when we're looking at her, we get no sound. When we go back to the ghost and the captain that's stalking her, we get the sound of him dragging the axe on the floor. And for her to have the wherewithal to reach down and touch the floor, it, I thought, was a really great dramatic moment. It's not enough to save that entire sequence of events that are happening on the base at that point, but it was a good moment that I enjoyed enormously.
We had quite a discussion about that here in the house, and it was not at my instigation. I forgot whether it was the kids or my wife brought it up. But they're like, if she was concerned that something was following her, and so she leans down and puts her hand on the ground, which I did not like the spider sense sequence there. But when she's like doing whatever, the daredevil or whatever it is, that she's suddenly able to sonically vibe out what's going on in the room, which is kind of what they showed visually. But why didn't she just turn around?
Fear.
That was the only argument I could make, but it's like, well,
she's afraid.
She's afraid to turn around and look, but she's not afraid to put her hand down to see if there is something coming. It's kind of...
People react very strangely when they're terrified.
Yes, yes.
They will behave in very illogical, very logical ways. And for her, possibly just being able to feel the sound around her. And, you know, the thing is, I've met people who are totally deaf, and they do have that sense when they touch, like the floor or something. That's not made up. That's real. I know people who can do that when they're deaf because their other senses are just so unbelievably heightened. So what she did was totally believable, because I've seen people do that.
I don't doubt that she can feel vibration in the floor. But the way that they visually portrayed it on
camera was for our benefit.
I didn't need that. If she put her hand down on the floor when he's dragging the axe across and an actress makes a facial gesture like, I have detected something, that would have been far more than enough to make that scene work without the special effects of, again, the
but that's what she
stuff.
Heard at that moment. That's what she's picking up in her skeletal structure. That's the sound that she's getting when she touches it. We're hearing what she's sensing. Everything at that point is all her point of view. So when she touches the ground, she's hearing the squeal and the banging. So we're now introduced to that. So we're getting what she's getting. At least that's the intent. So I didn't have a problem with it.
Anyway, because they showed an axe head, and that's the problem. They visually showed us in that whirling kaleidoscope the axe head. As if she is saying, oh, that's an axe and not a shovel or a spear gun or a stop sign or whatever.
Well,
the thing
she knows
could have been.
He's dragging an axe.
Not necessarily. She hadn't seen him. And every time he walks through a wall, he drops whatever he's carrying. So what did he pick up this time? I did not have
a problem with it. I found it totally believable.
So let's talk about having a deaf actress in the story. This year, Doctor Who has made it known in various ways that they are experimenting with expanded casting, which is fine. I'm pleased that they actually how to put this. You know, typically when a writer writes a story, there's a certain economy to what they put in there, notwithstanding the Soviet banners and whatnot on the thing. And I'm not saying that I'm a fan of that, but you know, it's what is it, Chekhov's gun? You show it.
Right. If you showed an act two, it's, you know, then it must have been used in act one, or if it's just laying there on the ground in act one, then you expect it to be used in act two or something to that effect, yeah.
So here we have a deaf actress, and she a perfectly acceptable job acting, and and it still ends up being somewhat critical to the story because she's the one that's able to lip read. She's the one that's able to figure out what it is that the ghosts are saying that allows the doctor to figure out the mystery of the things. What would have been wrong of having a deaf actress and that wasn't the fact that the one time the doctor lands somewhere in all of time and space with a deaf person, they need a deaf person to solve the problem? That I in a way I feel that that's not as they haven't done as generous a thing in their casting because they have then said, well, it's also a plot device. It's not just that we're casting deaf people. It's that it's a plot device. It's not that she's an ordinary person who could be in any ordinary circumstances. It's a person who has to have this special ability for us to figure it out.
I don't have a problem with that. There are two sides to that argument, I think. If you just put in somebody who is deaf and signs, who is just there, they could be accused of pandering just because there's a demand. You're not showing enough disabled people. Okay, we'll throw in a disabled person there. Well, you've just given into, you know, this pandering now.
Yeah, but you can make that same argument with this. Well, you just threw in a deaf person.
No, but you wrote a story. I mean, this is something we've talked about in other kinds of situations. You've created a story now where you need somebody who is integral to the plot who has this ability. And now through some sort of organic creation, you've come to a point where it now becomes necessary. I mean, and you make a good point there. The point that I'm making, though, is that there's no right or wrong here. I mean, whether they just stuck in a person who just happens to be deaf and that's just the way it is, you know, some people call that pandering, other people will not. They create a story here where, because you need a character who can have this ability to lip read. Okay, well, who's the best lip readers? Well, someone who's deaf. Okay, we go with that road. But then you get the other half of the people that are saying, well, now you're pandering through a plot device now. There's no winning on that. There's always going to be a critical audience that's going to say what you did was wrong, while the other half of the people are going to say what you did was fantastic.
Well, I'm not arguing that there's always going to be a group of people that are going to say it's wrong. The question is, would it have been more betterer? That's not the word I'm saying. In other words, the fact people are going to say it's pandering. No matter what, there's a group of people that say pandering. It doesn't matter whether it's a plot device or whether it's not a plot device. If you hire somebody who's not in the norm, they're going to call it a plot device.
Yeah, there are people that are going to. Yeah, there are people that will call it that.
There's no doubt about it. She was, as the doctor said, she was the smartest person in the room when he wasn't there. She was an extraordinary human being, irregardless of the hearing issue. So if she had solved the problem or figured out, instead of just them whispering, if it had been something else and she had been the person who had brought that information out to light through being a clever person, I can't help feeling that it would be more saying this is just a deaf person can just be as effective as everyone else in the same ways as everyone else and not just because she has this extra ability that she's had to overcome with it. And it's such a fine line there. And I just kind of, it actually makes me feel like it's pandering more because they did have to work it in and they couldn't just hire a deaf actress and not go on beyond that and say, okay, well, the base commander, second in command is deaf. So what? Go on. And be done with it. And it makes me worry.
Well, I think
that they can't cast somebody who is differently abled or different from the mainstream conception of normal
You make a point. You make a good point. And I think part of that stems from the history of television production. And that is by nature of not casting people like that on a regular basis – it always becomes the big elephant in the room. It's not until we can get to that point where it starts to get a little bit more exposure that we can finally get to that stage where we say, okay, this person just happens to be deaf, and then you move on. We're not there yet. And until the handicapped in some fashion or another get more regular exposure to the point where we cease to be uncomfortable with it, then we can reach that point where we just say, okay, and move on. We're not there yet because Hollywood or the BBC or whoever is putting these television shows out is not there yet. And I don't know if that's due to the fact that they don't have enough actors that are handicapped in that particular area. I mean, to be honest, I don't know very many deaf actors and actresses.
Well,
to be honest,
and
this is only the second that I know of.
And that's a very real concern. I kind of doubt that there are too many actors who are permanently disabled in wheelchairs who are out treading the boards, as it were, at the theater.
And
that's
a fault of the industry, I would say, because people are not writing roles for people who are disabled. That's part. So you do get that situation where there is some kind of pandering here. What they're doing, they're writing roles for people that let me rephrase this. Roles are being written for people who are not disabled, thereby slamming the door on anybody that has a disability from getting their foot in the door and being able to have a role on Doctor Who or Star Trek or something like that. I mean, I remember when they got Michael Dunn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a big deal to get a dwarf. And they had to work that into the story somehow.
Well, and they would – in obviously, in some way, you have to work it in to the story, depending on what the disability is. I suppose it's almost impossible for a writer to not treat a disability as a disability. And I mean that in terms of it is something that you have to write you have to do extra work.
You have to treat it with kid gloves is what you have to do.
I mean, it's like, okay, we have this scene where the monster's coming, and then there's the guy who can't. He's got the braces and the crutches, and he can't walk. Oops, he's dead. No, we have to – he's a major character because we want to write them in as a major character, so we have to do something different to get him out of the room faster, though, and make the monster slower or whatever it happens to be. I mean, it is a challenge in – as is it a challenge in life. It is a challenge in writing, and I suspect that writers, not necessarily being challenged that way, are not particularly good at conceiving of it either.
So let me ask this. Would it have worked better if she, because she was deaf, had been hacked to death by the captain because she couldn't hear him coming up behind her? Would that have served better had she been killed because of her disability? How do you think what would you think about that? And then how do you think
jerk for losing her?
Well, yeah. But Clara notwithstanding, how do you think the viewing public would have liked that?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's not like they weren't hacking them up all over the place, not necessarily hacking them. They were pretty bloodless in most of the kills. But
yeah, but I'm assuming that he's going to be successful, this axe. Yeah, it's a safe bet that she's going to be pretty well dismembered.
I think it would not play to people's sense of fair play. In other words, if she'd run down a corridor, she knew about it, and she ran down to a corridor, and she got to a door that was locked, and the creature slowly, inexorably caught up with her and killed her, then that falls into the category of the standard axe murderer kill. And in this, if she were going down the corridor and never knew it was coming until it got her, one, well, there's suspense for the audience, but there's no suspense or terror for her, which doesn't give us...
No, because we're supposed to feel the suspense. Well, you're right. There is some kind of suspense that we're feeling as she's being stalked. But the real terror comes from what they see. I mean, that's classic horror, that whatever terror the victim is about to feel, especially if it's a sympathetic victim.
Right.
Then, yeah, that gets carried over to us. We're supposed to be identifying with that victim when that kind of happens. And true, she would not be in that particular situation unless she turned around, as you said, too late, right as the hammer is about to hit, so to speak.
Yeah, no. No, and I totally like the character, and I'm not in any way saying that it wasn't a well done job and it did integrate well into the story. Anything like that. That she was one of the characters I liked better. The other, there was only two things. No, there's only one thing about her character that I didn't care for, and one thing that wasn't explained satisfactorily to my mind. The first that wasn't explained is, why did she keep stopping her translator from going in there and looking at that?
You know, I rewatched part one yesterday, and
I felt like she knew something she wasn't telling anybody. You know, it's one of those things, like, maybe she's part of it and she realizes that if you go in and look at it, you got a problem. So she's going to stop him from looking at it because she loves him, obviously.
Well, she's very overly protective of him, as we clearly saw.
But walking into a big empty spaceship and looking around, she was like immediately shut it down. No, you're not going in there. That's you. Don't go. Don't go. And I felt like there was supposed to be something that would later materialize that she knew something about it.
No, and that is true. That makes for a bad plot device. I mean, it obviously works out in his benefit.
Yes, it did.
But it would have been kind of nice if we had gotten something else instead of her just not allowing him in. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it could have been anything, you know, his duties, other sense of, you know, or sets of circumstances that prevented him from going in there, not her pushing him away.
Yeah.
Pushing him away from going into the ship. That would have played a lot better. I agree.
And the other thing is, and this is not just her, but it's also the guy that went back with the doctor into the 1980s. And that was the suddenly I'm reading you and you're such a callous manipulator of people. And in her case, she's talking about Clara.
Right.
And in his case, you know,
I think he's a little
talking
more
about the fact that those people are died in that order. And
he's a little more accurate in that. Although the doctor did tell her to stay in.
Mm-hmm.
He did say stay in the TARDIS, and she did choose to go out. So really the flaw, you know, the fault is not with the doctor. So I think that argument does not hold any water in this particular case. Although when the doctor was confronted with that, he really didn't defend himself.
No. So
and as far as Clara goes, her analysis was dead on right. Even
yes,
as she explains it, I'm thinking, yeah, you know, that actually makes sense, because he was approached by the ghosts and they did nothing.
Well, the doctor had explained that in part one too.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, but
that's
why
they took
us
in there and showed it to us. And then once they showed it to us, then they wanted to kill us.
Right.
And it was the same with him. And so, yeah, it was, she was just reminding us of what had already been determined in the previous episode.
Now I've been seeing a lot of comments from people, and I do not buy it, that the Clara is turning more into the doctor by virtue of this callousness that she is showing, this disregard for life, by telling him to go out of the Faraday cage in an attempt to get the phone back. And I don't believe it. I mean, yeah,
doctor wouldn't do that.
No, true.
The doctor would have gone out himself.
He would have gone out himself, or actually, no, I wouldn't. Yeah, he would have gone out himself. But if he could not, he would have had that guy go out there for the same reason. And he would have explained he is safe. So long as he doesn't go on that ship, he's safe.
I agree the doctor would have taken him, but I think the doctor would have gone with him.
Possibly. I'm just saying if the doctor could not have done it.
Yeah.
If there was anything preventing the doctor from going outside the Faraday cage, he would have come up with the exact same same idea. Now, and I agree with Clara's response, which was being, you do what needs to be done. I think her decision to go to make that selection, say, you go out there, you get the phone, she was spot on right. And I think that's when we get this sense of overprotection from Cass. because for someone who's supposed to be the second smartest person in the room, she's certainly not getting that.
You would have thought that for the second smartest person in the room, when she was walking with Clara, that she would have a lifetime of experience that would say, hey, maybe I shouldn't lose sight of Clara.
Starters. So now we get the inconsistency in her character. Her splitting off from Clara was ridiculous, just as ridiculous as Clara going up and down the hall saying, Cass, Cass.
Actually,
it's like,
that. I appreciated that. As soon as she said it the first time, I'm like, Clara, she's dead.
Duh. She can't hear you.
She got about two or three, and then Clara at least went,
and she figures it out. She said, duh.
Yeah. So I thought that was an amusing moment.
It was.
And it is hard for people not to fall into your patterns.
Yeah, a person would forget.
They're lost.
What
do I do? I call for them. Oh, yeah.
But Cass would know better.
She should know better, and
she did not. She made a big mistake by splitting off from Clara like that, just as she did regarding her future boyfriend. As Clara sends him out, she should have realized that Clara's explanation was absolutely right. But she's not thinking clearly.
She's in love.
She's wildly in love. And okay, I suppose one could say that when a person feels that way, that they're going to forget logic, they're going to forget reason, they're going to forget their intelligence, and they're just going to think with their irrational heart. To some degree, I suppose. But when Clara explains it to her, she still doesn't get it, and instead, she, for all intents and purposes, is basically telling Clara to f off.
And I didn't need a translator for that.
Didn't need a translator for that.
Yeah. So what else have we got in this story? I wanted to mention, I really, really, really thought that the first half of this was, I such incredibly high hopes for this.
Loved part one.
And
I thought the cliffhanger was great, but unlike you, I find it fascinating that you were pinning a lot of hopes on part two. I finished watching part one, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, what a solid story. I loved it. It was fantastic. They're going to drop the ball in part two. I know they are, because they just have to.
Well,
I was expecting, and maybe that's what, I liked it, because I was expecting it to actually be a lot worse.
I have come to learn to expect for Moffat to drop the ball in a two-parter, but there have not been that many authors on Doctor who have written two-parters. I mean, it's largely Russell T. Davies and Moffat.
Yeah.
So Moffat has, on a regular basis, disappointed me in his cliffhangers or his second parts. And so I had hopes. And looking back over the stories, and I know there's going to be screams now, but looking back over the stories that Toby Whithouse has done, School Reunion was okay.
I liked it, but I liked
Sarah
it because of Sarah.
Yeah, the rest of it was meh.
The rest of it is meh. I mean, it's okay.
Okay,
it's okay.
Vampires in Venice, meh.
Oh, I hated Vampires in Venice.
Vampires in Venice. The God Complex, meh.
I didn't care for that too much, really. No, not
really. So, A Town Called Mercy, meh.
Did not like that.
Writing to be pedestrian.
Yeah,
it's okay.
I agree.
It's pedestrian.
Yeah.
And so I kind of really expected him to maintain. I mean, yes, good part one, excellent part one. I kind of had this feeling like he would be slow and steady, as opposed to very erratic and mercurial as Moffat's two-parters are. So, and I think that's why I thought it would be better, because I figured both halves would be roughly the same, and the first half was really great, so therefore the second half should be roughly the same.
Yeah,
and it wasn't. It was like he was trying to imitate Moffat's style of screwing up a two-parter.
I have to wonder, and I only learned about this through last season, where Moffat has not necessarily contributed to a story by which he then gets to share the writing credit, but he influences the story.
Well, he is a script editor.
And he did that with Mummy on the Orient Express, for one. He got no script writing credit on that, but he demanded that a scene be inserted early on between the Doctor and Clara, which to me was the weakest moment in the entire episode. So I have to wonder here, how much influence did Moffat put on part two? Because this really feels... it's definitely a step down from what we got the previous week.
Assuming that the theme of the year is the Doctor's fatalistically worried he's going to die, then I could see how Moffat might be interjecting into the stories and insisting that the Doctor's behavior be fatalistic. And I mean, obviously, it's pure speculation, but it is two stories in a row that have had that feel to it. And, you know, that is... And I'm going to say the problem with a showrunner, because that's not what I'm getting at. But in other words, when they're trying to do these series-long arcs and thematic arcs through the story, then they do at times insist on inserting things into the stories.
Yeah, you have to shoehorn these ideas.
And if it isn't organic, it doesn't work right.
It doesn't fly. And I think that's what we got here, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, again, we have no proof. We only have the two full stories to go on, but it's still that situation, this fatalism that seems to be present. I mean, obviously, we'll have next week's, you know, and the week after to get a better sense. And if we see that again,
mm-hmm.
then we'll know, okay, this is clearly the theme. I mean, I will look at it with a very skeptical eye right now. I mean, it could be coincidence.
There was no mention of the hybrid this time.
No, but it is very coincidental that we've had two full stories in a row where you have this kind of fatalism / paradoxical situation here that the Doctor is caught up in. Two in a row. If there's a third, then we know there's a theme.
So what do you think of the Doctor breaking the fourth wall there?
That was weird. And totally, I'm not going to say we've never had that. There have been moments where the Doctor has broken the fourth wall briefly, but it's like a sentence here or a word there, something like that. And
it could almost be taken as speaking to himself.
Yeah, almost. But it was meant for our benefit, and it's always done as a joke. So you can just, again, those get hand waves. Here, I mean, this is a full-out prologue where that is being addressed to us.
Yeah, because he's moving around the TARDIS, and he's always looking at the camera. So, he is absolutely talking to us.
I am of two minds on this. The first is, this is the strangest thing I've ever seen, and it's not taking me out of the story, because I'm not in the story yet. I mean, all I've got is what I saw in part one.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm in part two, so I'm not in this new story yet. So he's not taking me out, but I couldn't help but feel that I was being given something that was completely outside the norm of anything Doctor Who has ever done. So it was very bizarre.
If he'd done it at the beginning of part one...
Now, that might have worked.
Then when the Doctor popped up dead, you would have known that had something to do with the bootstrap paradox.
Yeah. And that might
so that
worked.
Would have detracted from the cliffhanger.
Now, granted, and he can't. He can't talk to Clara because she's on the base.
He wouldn't have any reason to do.
No,
like, oh, I'm going to start talking about a bootstrap paradox because
no, it's
from our own standpoint. The Doctor doesn't know it's a bootstrap paradox yet.
No,
either.
But so now comes to the other point of view that I have on this. It's sort of necessary because we need to understand the idea of the bootstrap paradox in order to appreciate what it is that the Doctor is about to do. And then, of course, he gives it a tiny bit of a summation at the very end, and then he brings back the whole Beethoven idea.
Right, which is even weirder, because he is now actually in story explaining to Clara, and he gets enough of the point across to Clara that she understands the situation, and she's, you know, ooh, my mind's blown, that hurts, whatever. And then, you know, he says, and who wrote Beethoven's?
Yeah, but he's not saying that to her. He's saying that to us. He broke the fourth wall again.
But she's there in the room this time, so it kind of... Yeah,
it's very moonlighting.
It's very wrong. I mean, I don't hate it.
No, I don't know what to think about that. I don't hate it. I
would have been much happier if they'd had one at the beginning of every episode, and so we could treat this like it's some sort of trading cards where they talk about temporal paradoxes or something, and then they fooled us.
Yeah, and I think that's what really throws me, and it was what I said. It's completely outside the norm. We've never had anything like that before. It is the strangest story gimmick ever in Who to pull this kind of narrative. The method in which you're going to set up your story. We've never had anything like that in all of Who history. So to all of a sudden toss it out now was unusual, but you've got to introduce the bootstrap paradox. You can't, as you said, you can't do it in part one because
no,
that gives away the ghost.
Couldn't the writer have done it when he explains it to Clara? At the end, he could have explained it to Clara. He had to explain the paradox to her in brief terms.
You know,
and he could have used the time that they wasted at the beginning.
Instead,
do it to Clara.
They could have bumped up some of the initial, the first couple of moments right after the opening credits. By the way, awesome rock guitar playing there, Peter.
Yeah, I noticed that.
I liked it, to be honest.
Anything helps hide the sound of the rats
of
being tortured.
Of the rat that's being mutilated. Yeah, take the first few moments, create your little mini cliffhanger prior to the credits, push that up front, and then expand on the explanation. That would have worked better, and instead, because now what we have is now we're looking for the bootstrap paradox. By introducing it up front, now we're looking to find it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now we're trying to see where it is. And at that point, he could have used the Beethoven example at that very moment, and it would have worked a lot better. It would have made for a better story. I would have liked it a lot better, I think. Yeah, but of course, I'm now looking at this sort of backwards. It was interesting to have the idea of the paradox right up front for my benefit. So, you know, but this then falls into the story point.
Nothing he talks about in the story, I mean, from that point forward, nothing he talks about until right when we get to the solution is actually referring to about the bootstrap paradox per se. Dealing about the immutability of time. It's like it happened.
And that's what I'm wondering. How would our knowledge of the bootstrap paradox up front like we got. I mean, how would if they had moved that to closer towards the epilogue of the story, how would we have felt about the Doctor coming up with a scheme like he did in this episode? I mean, that's the one thing that we've complained about, how we don't get to see the Doctor being clever.
There's another place where he could have explained the bootstrap paradox, and it would have made sense in the context of the story, or it could have been made to make sense in the context of the story. And that is when they went back in time 20 minutes and the guy wanted to save the woman. That could have been a moment for the Doctor to enlighten him about, well, if you saved her, then you wouldn't be here, and then how would you loop around?
I think that's the grandfather paradox.
It is that specifically. Well, that's killing your own grandparent. I don't know about saving somebody paradox, whether that counts as the grandfather paradox or not. But in other words, there is an opportunity to introduce paradoxes into the narrative of the story for the knowledgeable person to be explaining it to. Like I said, it wouldn't have worked exactly the way they had it, but they could have just rewritten it a little bit. I mean, her death was really pointless. They could have worked this with that 20-minute time loop in place. They could have worked that in somehow, so that he could have been explaining it to the other guy, too. So, I mean, that's another place where you could have naturally kind of explained it.
So the point is that there are better ways that they could have done this instead of just giving us that strange monologue that the Doctor's giving to us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It was very unusual. And again, I didn't necessarily hate it, but I truly didn't love it.
Yeah.
All I did was, in fact, to be honest, I actually thought, did I miss something? Did I miss an episode? Am I watching the right episode? I actually had these questions like, am I really? There was a moment about 30 seconds into that prologue where I thought, am I watching the right episode? And then I thought, no, wait a minute. They just showed previously on Doctor Who and we saw the clips. So I thought, okay, so this is the right one. But boy, is this weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. All right. One other thing, and then we'll leave this poor episode alone. Toby Whithouse has now inflicted on us twice in a row, and I'm using the word inflicted, so I'm probably giving away my feelings about the Tivolians.
Oh, yeah.
I did not like the Tivolian in the God Complex. I do not like the Tivolian here. I know you're not supposed to exactly like them anyway, but nonetheless, it's not just that they're slimy and icky. It's just stupid.
Well, it is stupid, and of course, we're meant to think that they're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that simple. We're meant to think that they're stupid. You know, I just realized something.
And they made a deal about having this guy in it, and he was in it for like, 30 seconds worth of dialogue, perhaps, maybe 45, and then they snuffed him.
Yeah.
You
know, I just realized something. Toby is really good at writing spooky stories, because the first part of the God Complex, when all we think is that we're in this hotel, or the Swiss chalet, I think is what it was supposed to be. For the first part of that entire story, where people are just disappearing, there was something creepy about it, which I liked. It wasn't until we got to the end, where the Nymon then gets introduced, the Tivolian was just irritating. But just forget the fact that the Tivolian is there. The first part of the entire story where you've got this mystery and everybody, you're opening up the door and finding your own fear and things like that. I mean, there was some real creepy factors to that. And now we've got this two-parter that the first part, it's somewhat of a claustrophobic kind of story, because it's set in this very contained sea base with these ghosts that are chasing him. And now we get into the creepy factor. I really think Moffat needs to just back off and let Toby write a creepy episode.
Toby also the guy who created Being Human, so I mean that's his show. He is a horror genre type.
And the British Being Human is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I think it's a fantastic show. I think he's got some really good intentions with trying to craft some spooky episodes with Who. I think that this is not the avenue, because unless he's allowed to write an episode that's creepy from start to finish, then I think his talents are being wasted.
Oh, speaking of talents not being wasted, I promised the Tivolians would be the last thing, but it's not. That base, that underwater base, has got to be the best thing they've ever put together in terms of design. I didn't feel like it was a reused house.
No.
Or that center in Wales that they're constantly using for futuristic. The accoutrements, the furnishings and everything, the trays and the refrigerators it was perfect.
Excellent production values.
Yeah, it looked fantastic.
And that helped lend itself to the spooky factor when the ghosts are now coming out. It really helps to create a believable atmosphere for us, the viewer, as we're seeing the people, falling one by one as they're being pursued by the ghost. Excellent. I agree. It was wonderful.
So kudos to the production staff there for that.
Yeah. That was a very rich episode. Well, and I don't doubt that it probably cost them a nice pretty penny to put that one together, but also rich in texture.
And just to carry that across, last time the Dalek City was, kind of hokey in that Dalek City sort of way, but it was absolutely perfect compared to the original Dalek cities, right down to the shapes of the doors and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of detail has gone into the set
and I
design.
Like that. I think the detail is fantastic. That does it does a good job of whatever world building you're trying to do to tell your story. So yes, I think that's absolutely fantastic. So yeah, great stuff there.
So next time when we get around to Doctor Who, it's going to be the girl who died and the woman who lived.
It looks like a Viking type episode.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what Eretz said, and I couldn't tell.
They definitely said Viking, so I'm gonna go with the Vikingian age, or no, it would be the Vikingian era. That's what it would be on the Eighth Doctor's TARDIS's big wheels.
Ah,
right, yeah, I think that would be it. So
I think you're right. Yeah, and this is the episode that a lot of people are kind of curious about because of the trailer that was leaked, the season trailer. That was leaked a couple of months ago, or not so leaked, but it was premiered, where we see this young girl played by, I think it's Maisie Williams is her name. And she said, the doctor says, "You." And she says, "You know, where have you been, old man?" Something to that effect. And of course, we keep being told, "Oh, we've never seen her before. We don't know who she's supposed to be." But clearly the doctor does. And, okay.
So I've seen the speculation. Oh, it's Susan. Oh, it's Romana. Oh, it's the Ronnie. It's always, always, always. Every time the doctor recognizes somebody, it's bound to be somebody like that.
Somebody that we know,
but it's not going to be that. It's going to be somebody that the doctor knows, and it's not even going to be somebody that the doctor knows today. It's going to be somebody that the doctor meets Saturday, probably in the first episode, and he'll think she's dead because she's the girl who died. And then, I don't know, maybe she'll be infused with Captain Jack power or something. And then in the next episode, set 100 years in the future, because I think the second episode is set in Victorian times. I don't know where I got that from, but I have no idea where you got that from.
The
clothing she's wearing looks that way, too. It's definitely sort of Pride and Prejudice look. So, in that one. So I'm thinking that "you" is the recognition of her from the first one, only a few hundred years in the future. And then he's like, "Well, what's taking you so long?"
I don't know.
That's what they've done time and time again.
Yeah, well, you make a good point, but I don't think that's what they're doing, because I seem to remember she took off like a helmet.
She took off her bonnet, I thought.
I thought it was something.
It's like a highwayman's hat.
I didn't get that. Maybe you're right. It's been a long time since I've seen it now. But you probably make a very good point. It would be a very irritating cheat.
That's certainly
one of
it is,
many. I mean, it plays right up there with red herrings, you know, and Moffat's very good.
We're
going to
find out the name of the doctor now. No, we're not.
Oh, God.
We don't care.
That's the one thing that Moffat's really pissing me off about, is he loves to give us red herrings. He just really needs to stop.
A red herring in the story, I don't mind. A red herring in the promotional material is kind of annoying.
Well, it depends on the red herring. I mean, there's small little red herrings, and then there's big whopping ones. And lately, he's given us huge ones. And
anyway,
I hate that.
Anyway, Ben, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fusionpatrol. Our Twitter username is @fusionpatrol, or you can just send us a comment at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Come check out our new YouTube channel at youtube.com/fusionpatrol. Please, come join the conversation. Our music is "Fight the Future" by Amber Wolfe.